wish I was a mole in the ground. If I was a mole in the ground, I'd root that mountain down. And I wish I was a mole in the ground.
Good morning to all our listeners in the greater Portland area and beyond. You are tuned to KBOO Portland, your community radio station, still on the air in the time of coronavirus. And it's time now for the Old Mole Variety Hour, your source for news, reviews, and interviews from a socialist, feminist, anti-racist, and anti-colonial perspective. I am Patricia Kohlberg, your host for the hour. The moles tunnel beneath the surface of denials, obfuscations, and downright lies for the truth that we hope will help set us free of a system that degrades the planet and degrades our lives upon it. If you like what you hear today and you have the resources, please consider a donation to KBOO to help carry the station through this difficult time. Today on The Old Mole, we take aim at two of the four crises the world faces at the moment: income inequality and racial oppression. The other two, in case you're wondering, are pandemic disease and global warming. Almost 4 months into a paralyzing pandemic and severe economic recession, we find ourselves in a moment of hope and renewal as the Black Lives Matter inspired and led protests continue at a level unprecedented in my lifetime. In many locales, important reforms in policing have resulted, but perhaps more importantly, the protests have engendered a national conversation about race that takes seriously the centuries-old grievances of people of color, and especially Black and Indigenous people. Whether and how this uprising will lead to transformative change is a topic that Bill Resnick takes up with longtime activist and strategist Michael Albert. Also on our show today, Tom Becker reads from an article by Jason Hinkle about the remedies for global poverty, and Desiree Helligers interviews Vancouver, Washington educator and activist Adam Aguilera about the recent declaration by a councilwoman that systemic racism does not exist in our sister city to the north. To close our show, Norm Diamond reads and comments on a poem for our times by Irish poet John O'Donohue. Our music clips today recognize the work of Black artists, including Rick James, Gil Scott-Heron, and Andra Day, who sing and rap about police violence and Black resistance. First up on our show today, we have Bill Resnick speaking with Michael Albert about the current insurgency triggered by the murder of George Floyd and how all the anger and hope could be organized into a struggle for life after capitalism. Michael Albert lays out the values that should underlie a social transformation and discusses the kind of institutional change that would make it possible to construct a society that works for the benefit of all. Albert is a staff member of Z Magazine and author of innumerable books on anti-capitalist organizing strategy.
Hi, Michael Albert. Welcome to KBOO.
Hi, thanks for having me.
In 1965, Michael Albert was studying physics at MIT. He got politically active in the civil rights and anti-war movements, got expelled from MIT, became a full-time activist, writer, co-founded South End Press and Z Magazine, wrote a slew of books, among them Pericon, which stands for Participatory Economics. It's subtitled Life After Capitalism. Also the book Practical Utopia Strategies for a Desirable Society. And he does a weekly podcast, Revolution Z. Look for it on the web. Today we're going to talk about the current remarkable insurgency triggered by the murder of George Floyd and how all the anger and hope can be organized into struggle for life after capitalism. In a world living in harmony with natural ecosystems upon which our lives depend. So, Michael, you've written on those remarkable, in some ways historic features of the current uprising. Tell us about it.
As far as the uprising, I have never seen anything like it, and I'm not a youngster. I'm 73, and in my life, I've never seen anything that even comes close to the kind of sustained involvement coming from huge numbers of people and dispersed very, very widely across the country. So what marks this as quite unique and different is its duration, its intensity without flagging, and even more so perhaps that it isn't located, you know, in Washington and New York and San Francisco alone, but it's in all those kinds of places, but also far more widely spread into small towns and cities across the country. And that's a level of sustained activism that is markedly unusual.
Yeah, also, it seems to me how it's organized. It's so horizontal. There are groups all over Portland. When you look at the BLM website calendar, they're self-organized by people, not just in the central city and not, in fact, by the established groups, but in parks all over the city. There are picnics for Black Lives Matter that draw people and marches through the streets night after night.
It's even in small towns in some places. It remains to be seen, however, how long it can sustain itself if it doesn't develop a degree of infrastructure, a degree of shared demands and shared focus and shared methods across all those venues, across all those cities and states, to give it a degree of hope and a degree of learning. What's happening right now is that people are learning separately from one another. They're learning the experiences of organizing and of working together and of solidarity and also of the difficulties that arise. And to congeal that into lasting memories that people will be able to learn from is important, and then to be able to congeal it into some structure. In the 60s, we were very good at sort of what's happening now, widespread demonstrations, widespread activism, but we were not so good at, in fact, we were pretty poor, at having all of that energy and all of those lessons be embodied in a lasting movement, in a movement that would not die down, but would instead continue to grow and continue to diversify in its focuses. That we were not so good at. And that's the bane of my existence, that we didn't do better, because I think if we had done better, we'd be living in a different world now, different certainly than Trump and the garbage that we have. And so it's very important that this time around, in an upsurge that actually is wider than the 60s and more sustained, not than the 60s were over the years, but more sustained in its demonstrations than the 60s, but it needs to congeal into lasting commitments that are shared among all these people, and so that people don't sort of come to a point of exhaustion or come to a point of feeling like, oh, can we won some stuff and that's the end of it, but rather that it keeps growing and keeps demanding and moves on to talk about, you know, not just dealing with police violence, which is incredibly important, and not just dealing with systemic racism, which is even more important on a larger scale, but dealing with all of the vile attributes of contemporary society, the race and ethnic and cultural attributes, but also the gender and kinship attributes, the economic attributes, the political attributes, and begins to formulate some kind of a vision of a better society that we could live in.
This is Bill Resnick here at KABU Radio talking to Michael Albert, a longtime activist, writer, co-founder of Z Magazine, a podcaster on building a participatory society and economy. Michael, you've written a great deal on that participatory society and economy, and you've given examples. Why don't you first, though, talk about what it means, a participatory society, economy, and then we'll get into the examples. The examples that you choose, we surely can't go into all of them.
Well, the idea of participatory society is to think through what we would like a society to achieve for people. And once we have some degree of clarity about that, to try and think through what kinds of institutions could accomplish those goals that we have. So in other words, it's not just to say, well, we want freedom, we want justice, we want equity, we want people to be able to care about one another, we want people to be able to have fulfilling lives. It's to go further than that and to specify that a bit more and to then think about what kind of institutions are needed to accomplish those aims. So let's do the example of the economy, since that's the part that I've spent most time on, though I've spent a lot of time on the other parts as well. So regarding the economy, when I think about it, an economy affects how much stuff we have. It affects what kind of decisions we're able to make. It affects how we relate to one another. So I want to try and have some values, some aspirations around those things. So for the how much stuff we get, the aspiration that I have is for equity. And the idea there is there should be a fair amount of the social product for each person. And what determines what a fair amount is? Well, to my thinking, it's that people should get from the economy back for how much work they do, how hard they work, how long they work, the onerousness of the conditions under which they work. But they shouldn't get income because they own property. They shouldn't get income because they have more power than somebody else. They shouldn't even get income because they're more productive in the sense of having special talents or special skills. If we're lucky enough to get that at birth, then that's enough. We shouldn't be rewarded for it later. We should get income for duration, intensity, and onerousness of socially valued labor. And for decision-making, it seems to me, people should have a say in decisions to the extent that they're affected by them. In other words, if I'm more affected by something, I should have some more say in it. If I'm less affected, I should have some less say in it. And that's a norm that can be applied to everybody. It's called collective self-management. And I'm going quickly, but you also want people are going to interact with one another. They're going to have exchanges with one another. They're going to have attitudes toward one another. And you want an economy not to produce an environment that's dog-eat-dog, that's a rat race, in which people view each other as means to an end. You want an economy which produces an environment in which people's well-being depends on the well-being of others, in which for me to get ahead, you have to get ahead, and vice versa. So that instead of being opponents in a struggle in which one wins and one loses, we're sort of allies in a process in which all benefit. And if you take these kinds of norms and some more, I don't want to go on too long on your radio show. If you take these kinds of norms and you think them through, then you have to ask yourself, okay, what institutions do we want? Because to me, when somebody asks the left, well, okay, I get that you don't like racism. I get that you don't like sexism. I get that you don't like all these things. You say it so often, I get it, but what do you want? And the left is very poor at answering that question. Typically, the left can answer it in the short term. Well, we want a higher minimum wage. We want affirmative action. And it can answer it in terms of short-term reforms, which are valuable and good and part of a process of creating a new society. But what it has trouble doing is conveying to people a picture that's compelling and that is workable of a society that would yield all these desirable outcomes automatically of its own. Markets don't do that. The corporate division of labor doesn't do that. Profit-seeking doesn't do that. The kinds of institutions that we have, in other words, are contrary to our values. They're contrary to, you know, people being the most fulfilled, mutually supportive members of a social system that we could be. They're the exact opposite of that. They produce the opposite. So we want different institutions, and it's incumbent on us to explain what those institutions can look like, how they might function. Why? Two reasons. One, to provide hope, to provide motivation. And a second reason is so we can orient our strategy to attain what we're trying to attain. When we look at the history of the left, we notice that sometimes incredibly well-meaning, incredibly courageous, incredibly industrious and energetic people have in fact caused transitions not to what they really mostly wanted, not to their aspirations, but to other things instead that were much less desirable and sometimes even undesirable. And so we need vision both for motivation and to orient our activities. And the kinds of work that I and people like me do on things like participatory economics or participatory society are trying to provide that kind of contribution.
Let's get to some of those institutions, what they would look like struggles in healthcare,
what should we be fighting for in terms of reforms, and how that fight for reforms can also prefigure and show us what we're really, and fight for what we're really asking for, which is a good healthcare system. This is Bill Resnick for the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm talking to Michael Halbert. He's been talking about the potentials for this insurgency that we really have to sort of crystallize the struggle and the ideals that it represents into a vision of the future that we can actually work for in the many movements. Michael, in Practical Utopia Strategies for a Desirable Society, you do talk about other examples. I know you have your your ecology chapter is called Your Participatory Ecology. And I know you've dealt with energy systems. Tell us about what kind of energy system you imagine.
Well, there's two different issues here when you talk about energy in society. One is technical. Where does the energy come from? What kinds of sources are employed? And the other is social. How is it organized and how is it distributed? So the technical one is technically complicated, but it's not politically complicated. You want to use energy sources that are as free of pollution and as sustainable as possible for obvious reasons. I mean, this couldn't be much more elementary. You don't want to use up stuff that you've become dependent on, and you don't want to create a mess. And so movements have gravitated toward solar and wind, water, to use these sources in a manner which is conducive to sustainability, to not despoiling the atmosphere and the ground. That part is for, I think, engineers and ecological scientists, and then movements to win. The other part of the issue, though, which is distribution, if you will, is very different. And that's like the whole rest of the economy. What is the appropriate way to think about, or the caring and humane way to think about, energy? Well, given a certain amount of energy, should it be used on things that are of benefit only to a very few people? Should huge amounts of energy go to pursuits that benefit relatively few people? And when it's put that way, the answer is no. And as soon as you put it that way and you answer it no, you begin to realize, well, maybe we should do something about the gigantic stores of energy that are wasted on producing weapons that, thank God, are never used. It would be even worse if they were used. On producing transportation systems that are about as insane as they could be. In other words, cars, which are very energy inefficient and which despoil the atmosphere, one per family or two per family in some cases, or even three in some cases. These little vehicles moving around in the most inefficient way one could imagine instead of a public transportation system and a sensible construction of, for that matter, cities and towns. And, you know, you can go on through these things, but I honestly think they are not the heart of the matter. The heart of the matter, at least in my mind, of these kinds of issues is how we socially organize. So, for instance, let's take, you mentioned healthcare. The easy answer is, well, there should be free healthcare for everyone. Okay, we're done with that. But that's not quite all there is to it. Who delivers that healthcare? So let's take a hospital. If we consider a hospital now, first of all, they're profit-oriented. They're privately owned, many of them, most of them. They're privately owned. They pursue profits. That means they do all kinds of procedures and operations that have very little to do with healthcare, that are cosmetic and the like, to make money. They charge fortunes, way more than the cost of production warrants. Why? Because they have bargaining power, because people's lives are at stake. That's like pharmaceutical companies. So all those kinds of attributes which make it top-heavy for the rich and the powerful who benefit from the process, and meanwhile, those with less means get poor care or oftentimes no care and suffer from the process. So those kinds of things have to be eliminated. But let's look even more closely. Let's suppose we go inside of a hospital and we look at it not from the point of view of the patient, but from the point of view of the people who work there. So we have doctors and nurses and people who clean the place up. And let's just take those three for a moment. Those are starkly different. The situation of the different workers in the hospital is very different. It isn't just that somebody owns it who's outside the hospital and pocketing the profits. That's horrible. So that has to go. So that's what we mean by getting rid of private ownership. But what about dividing up the workforce so that about 20% does all the empowering tasks, has better circumstances, and earns way more? And 80% has more rote tasks, more repetitive tasks, tasks that are disempowering, that exhaust and diminish their ties to others and diminish their knowledge of the workplace. So the 20% is above the 80%. The 20% is a kind of a class above the 80%. 80% workers, 20% coordinator class. For me, the answer regarding healthcare, transportation, schooling, whatever you want to talk about, leads back inexorably to underneath the class relations and the gender relations and the racial relations. And it's those dynamics that have to be solved in order to solve those particular industries, the energy disposition also. So in the hospital, in the workplace, in the factory, wherever, what we have to do is create an environment that is conducive to people having self-managing say, to people being able to participate in the decisions that affect their lives, to people having a fair share of the income, which means for duration and onerousness and intensity of work. Notice, if we rewarded according to that norm right now in hospitals, the people who clean the place up would probably make the most money. And that makes sense, because if it wasn't for power, that would be the job that you would have to pay people the most to do, because it's the least fulfilling. All right, so the point here is that when we look at any area of life, we have to sort of address these broader, deeper issues if we want to develop a real vision. Take education. As long as it's the case that 20% do all the empowering work and 80% do rote and mechanical work where they're basically just taking orders, then the school system has to produce people in some sense who expect that and who are acclimated to that. And that's why, if you think about high school when you were in it a long time ago for me and you, but people think about it, you can remember that for some people, the school day is terribly onerous. And as the end of the day comes, they're sort of looking at the clock. And they're praying for those last 15 minutes to go by so they can get the hell out of the school. And then there are other people who enjoy school and who are benefiting from it. And what's the difference? It's not that they're genetically different. It's that school is structured so that 20% will become empowered and will run the show, and 80% will become acclimated to enduring boredom and taking orders. And that's, what is that part of? It's not a function just of the attitudes of teachers, much less the attitudes of students. It's rather a function of the way the whole economy is organized. That's what it needs. And so it puts pressure on the school system to deliver that. And the school system comes through. So if we want to move from vision to demands, or vice versa, we have to get a clarity about what are the real causes of the real injustices and pain that people endure, what are the structural solutions to that, and then what kind of demands can move us toward that.
Michael Albert, I want to thank you. We have to talk again about how hospitals and schools and every institution can be structured such that no job is a terrible job, that people have the opportunity and feel a sense of need to, in fact, be able to take on more responsible tasks and tasks that give them a sense of creativity and possibility. It seems to me it's not just paying people with the worst jobs more. It's eliminating every one of those worst jobs, giving people a capacity to do the menial jobs in the morning and do carpentry in the afternoon, which is an enormously creative job, and then go to the opera or whatever, concerts, or make your own music in the evening. Michael Albert, thanks so much for talking to us today.
Thank you for having me.
That was a clip from a 1981 song by Rick James entitled Mr. Policeman. Rick James wrote the song after police shot an unarmed friend of his in Buffalo, New York. Before that, we heard Bill Resnick speaking with Michael Albert about what could come next out of the uprising. Bill would like our listeners to know that Michael Albert disagrees with Bill's closing comments about how all lousy and hard jobs can be made into good work. Bill takes his inspiration from Karl Marx that we can all have fulfilling lives. We can be fisher people in the morning, carpenters in the afternoon, and musicians at night. Michael Albert believes this is too simplistic a notion and that there are better and more practical ways of making lousy work into fulfilling work. Stay tuned to The Old Mole for a future episode in which Bill and Michael Albert contend for their visions or maybe even find some common ground. Next up on our show, Tom Becker reads excerpts from an article entitled We Can't Grow Our Way Out of Poverty by Jason Hinkle in The New Internationalist. Hinkle argues that capitalist growth is not sustainable in the face of global warming and that resource redistribution, rather than economic development, is the solution to global poverty. We do not live, he reminds us, in a world of scarcity, but rather one of maldistribution of our planet's riches.
My reading today is a condensed version of an article entitled We Can't Grow Our Way Out of Poverty by Jason Hinkle. For more than half a century, economists and policymakers have focused fanatically on growth as the only feasible way to end global poverty and improve people's lives. But in an era of planet-wide ecological breakdown, that comfortable conventional wisdom is crashing to an end. Everything is about to change in the field of international development. In 2018, the UN's Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, IPCC, grabbed the world's attention with its report stating that to avert dangerous climate breakdown, we need to cut global emissions by half by 2030 and reach zero by 2050. It would be difficult to overstate how dramatic this trajectory is. The challenge is staggering in its scale. More growth means more energy demand, and more energy demand makes it all the more difficult to create enough renewable capacity to meet it. Think about it this way. With business as usual growth, the global economy is set to roughly triple in size by the middle of the century. That's three times more extraction, production, and consumption than at present, all of which will suck up nearly three times as much energy. It will be unimaginably difficult for us to decarbonize the existing global economy. Impossible to do it three times over in the short time we have left. Indeed, the goal of ending poverty has come to be the single greatest defense for growth at all costs thinking, with economists insisting that we have a moral imperative to do everything we can to clear the way for capital. How can we hope to respond to the crisis of global poverty at a time when aggregate growth is no longer an option? Do we just sacrifice the poor for the sake of the planet, as the rising tide of ecofascists is so eager for us to do? Fortunately, there is another way. We can end poverty right now without any additional aggregate economic growth at all. The key here is to recognize that we don't live in a poor world. On the contrary, we live in an incredibly rich world. Global poverty is a product not of any actual scarcity, but rather a systematic creation of artificial scarcity. This becomes clear when we approach the problem of poverty through the lens of inequality. The poorest 60% of humanity contribute the vast majority of the labor and resources that go into the global economy. And yet in return, they receive only about 5% of total global income. Meanwhile, the richest 1% alone capture some $19 trillion every year, nearly a quarter of the global GDP. Poverty isn't natural or inevitable. It is an artifact of the very same policies that have been designed to siphon the lion's share of global income into the pockets of the rich. Poverty is at base a problem of distribution. One conceptually easy way to fix this would be to use direct cash transfers, a kind of basic income for the global poor, funded by a tax on the incomes of the world's richest, or an accumulated wealth, or on our financial transactions, resource extraction, or carbon emissions. None of this would be particularly difficult to implement, and there are a number of credible proposals for how to do it. Probably the most important intervention would be to set a floor on international wages. Researchers estimate that workers in the global south lose anywhere from between $2 trillion and $4 trillion in underpaid wages each year, compared to a value of the labor they contribute to international trade. A global minimum wage pegged to each country's median income so as not to disrupt existing patterns of comparative advantage would go a long way towards redressing this imbalance. Perhaps more importantly, we could democratize the institutions of global economic governments, the World Bank, the International Monetary Fund, and the World Trade Organization, to give poor countries greater voice in the decisions that affect them and greater control over their own economic policy. All of these changes would enable the South to recapture a great share of existing global GDP, shifting income from the very richest to the world's majority. Of course, none of this will be easy. It will require an enormous struggle against those who benefit so prodigiously from the status quo. As a result, the battle against global poverty has become apolitical in the extreme, which is precisely why it has failed for so many decades to deliver meaningful results. The climate emergency changes this. It forces us for the first time to face up to the brutal inequities of the global economy. It forces us into the zone of political contestation. It forces, at last, a reckoning. This article is in the March-April 2020 issue of New Internationalist, entitled We Can't Grow Our Way Out of Poverty. Jason Hinkle is an anthropologist, author, and fellow of the Royal Society of Arts. His most recent book is The Divide, A Brief Guide to Global Inequality and Its Solutions.
That was Old Mole Tom Becker reading excerpts from Jason Hinkle's article about redistribution of resources as the only solution to growing global income inequality. A link to that article is already posted to the KBOO website, kboo.org. Now we hear about a very local controversy in Clark County, which is home to the city of Vancouver, Washington. Desiree Hellegers interviews Adam Aguilera, educator and activist, about calls for the resignation of County Council Chairperson Eileen Quiring following her declaration that systemic racism is not a problem in Clark County.
My guest this morning is Adam Aguilera, who is a high school English teacher with Evergreen School District. He was a 2019 candidate for the Vancouver City Council. He is a board member for the Washington Education Association, and he is also the former secretary and treasurer for the Evergreen Education Association. Adam, thank you so much for joining me this morning. Could you fill us in a little bit about what's going on with the Clark County Council Chair, Eileen Quiring, and the calls for her to resign?
There is growing outrage in the community where she claimed that systemic racism does not exist in Clark County. And what has happened as a result of different organizations like the NAACP, LULAC, along with the Washington Education Association Riverside Council, which represents almost 5,000 educators, the Columbian newspaper, which all of these different organizations have called for her resignation. Her response to that has been attacking those organizations by saying it's a knee-jerk reaction to call for her resignation, and then proceeds to continue to rant at public meetings that systemic racism does not exist. And she continues to actually make racist remarks, including things like comparing herself to a Confederate statue being torn down in the community, and using those people multiple times. And she also turned down the YWCA to have a listening session to educate and explain systemic racism to the council, because she wants them only to be nice to her in how they speak to her. And she wants to also include people into the discussion that do not believe that systemic racism is real in the county because she believes that it is, quote, a difference of opinion. However, the community is arguing that when it comes to systemic racism, that is not up for debate. There's no opinion or difference of opinion about it. You either believe racism exists or you are complicit.
This controversy kind of kicked off, I think it was last week, when the sheriff announced the intent to remove Blue Lives Matter stickers from off any vehicles and off officers' uniforms. And that's the point at which Eileen Quiring, she's, I think, the one out of the five members of the county commissioners who took issue.
The reason why the sheriff had removed those decals from public property is because if you look at the origin of the thin blue line flag, the origin of just the phrase Blue Lives Matter, it is actually a counter symbol and a counter phrase, and it was designed specifically to diffuse the attention that was being brought to systemic racism. You know, that's why it's a very divisive set of symbols or phrases when that they are used, and that it's not appropriate for them to be on public property where the public taxpayers, which includes taxpayers from the Black and Brown communities, you know, do not want to see a divisive racist symbol being carried by Clark County Sheriff's personnel and on public property. That speaks to how much work that we need to do as a county in all of our institutions to address anti-racism and racial justice.
Yeah, and I mean, there does seem to be quite a lot of support for Quiring's resignation. I think within 2 days, about 2,500 people had signed on to petitions. And
yeah, it's well over 5,000 now.
It seems worth mentioning that last year, the Vancouver PD had three fatal shootings. Two out of the three were of people of color, and the third person was a houseless person. So the issue of police violence in Vancouver has also been generating quite a bit of attention.
Yes, that is correct. And one of those two individuals of color was actually an Evergreen Public School student.
That was Clayton Joseph.
Was a tragedy in our community and traumatizing for our teachers and educators that were trying to support this student who recently immigrated to the United States and was hoping to, you know, start a new life here in the United States, you know, get a good education and become a productive member of the community. And in a moment of crisis, he was killed as a result of that by the Vancouver Police Department. And yeah, it's tragic that that's what happened to Clayton Joseph. And a lot of concern in the community about policing. There's a lot of ongoing work that we need to do as a community to make sure that we are dismantling institutional racism within our community. And all of those institutions represent the system that creates and perpetuates racism in our community. And it's important for viewers to understand that this isn't a recent thing. This isn't a modern thing. This systemic racism, again, has always existed since the founding of the colonies of the United States. It has never been addressed in a way where we have actively as a community gone through and dismantled these pieces. And it's in every institution in our community. It doesn't matter if it's a town hall, a police department, a school, a business. We are all affected by it.
And I think it's also just worth pointing to the examples that the NAACP letter to Quiring specifically called out. The state attorney general's recent findings that children of color are disproportionately disciplined over their white counterparts in Vancouver school districts. And that seems like a really important thing to keep in mind, given the fact that, you know, this racism also resulted in a creation of a sort of permanent class of exploited workers. And the letter calls out also the county's infamous history of workplace racial discrimination, lawsuits, substantial settlements, the inability to sustain meaningful workplace diversity, and disparities in local policing. And I know, Adam, that you in particular have been involved in diversity training, I think, for the school district, where there's a, you know, really substantial gap between the numbers of students of color in the school district and representations among the teachers.
Yes, that is correct. In fact, when I help out the school district in teaching in different elementary classrooms, for example, it's interesting when the students come up to me because I'm oftentimes the very first male teacher of color they have ever seen. And it's interesting seeing their reaction, particularly around my Black and brown students. And, you know, they'll always ask me about my last name, what they see the color of my skin, and they ask me where I'm from. They're genuinely curious because they do not see teachers reflected in who they look like or their culture. It is so important that we diversify our educator workforce so that we can also begin the process of dismantling our school to prison pipeline, because that is accurate. Our students of color are disproportionately disciplined in our schools, and a lot of it has to do with how the adults perceive them with their own implicit biases. Eileen Quiring, she is so deeply entrenched in her implicit biases that in some respects, I don't even think she realizes what she's saying half the time. I think some of it is deliberate and intentional in the comments that she makes. So it's kind of like an explicit bias, a micro assault to the community. But there's a lot of things that she says where it's almost comical. You just can't help but laugh because it's like, how can some of these words come out of a person's mouth?
I think it's important to note, though, that just very recently, you know, in terms of racism within the school, racism within public sector, we had a member of the Vancouver School Board, Mark Stoker, whose response to, it was on Twitter, right, to the protests around Black Lives Matter was to suggest what, two words, fire hoses, right? So invoking the specter of the violence that was turned on people protesting in the era of the civil rights movement. Also, it seems important to note that the Vancouver City Council actually has only had one BIPOC person on the city council since 1857, you know, despite the fact that Vancouver is growing in diversity. And it looks like in 2019, the Vancouver City Council looking at the possibility of creating electoral districts as a way of boosting the representation of people of color on the city council. And I'm not sure if that proposal has gone anywhere.
There's actually a sort of a task force that is looking into that, and their work is ongoing right now into the present. And yes, you bring up another example of systemic racism. If you look at the track record of publicly elected offices onto the Vancouver City Council, that is correct, that there has only been one Black man who has served in that role. And it speaks to just the larger issue of how there is a lack of representation within community and Clark County in general, where people of color can participate in the democratic process, can represent residents of Clark County. And we have a lot of work to do in that regard. And so for Eileen to continually be doubling down and making these comments that systemic racism does not exist because she personally does not see it, is an injustice to every resident of Clark County, particularly from our Black and brown communities.
Yeah, and I think you were pretty vocal in controversy surrounding Mark Stoker and the calls for his resignation. And more recently, you had a letter to the editor in the Columbian following the Columbian's publication of a quite racist cartoon in response to the Black Lives Matter. They did a, you know, very perfunctory apology, and then about 2 days later proceeded to publish yet another racist cartoon. So it's interesting that the Columbian is calling for Quiring's resignation, and that's obviously a really good thing. But the Columbian, I think, has its own issues, and you've been very public on that issue as well.
Yeah, and going back to speaking how this is in every institution, you know, that includes our own county newspaper. And the Columbian has a lot of self-reflection and educating and commitment to action to dismantling institutional racism as much as Eileen does. And what I'm hopeful is that in the editorial board's analysis of Eileen Quiring's comments, they did acknowledge that they do have to look at themselves as well to make those changes. And so I'm hoping that what Eileen has done has created a flashpoint in Clark County where we are all being self-reflective of how each of us can be anti-racists to dismantle institutional racism within our own communities. When you look at the Vancouver School Board, there is a very clear example where the Vancouver School District community said, no way, you've got to step aside. We are not going to have an older white male make a fire hose comment towards how protesters should be treated who are pursuing racial justice and social justice in our communities. And that's why, you know, he resigned basically like 24 hours after he made those comments. And now the Vancouver School Board actually just finished appointing to his vacant seat a Black woman to sit on the school board. And that is truly historical for the Vancouver School Board, making a commitment to anti-racism and showing action that they are going to have representation on their school board, that they are going to dismantle institutional racism in the Vancouver School District so that our students and our educators of color are part of that school district, feel safe, respected, and that their voice and concerns are validated for change.
Just wanted to call out one other thing with Quiring's recent comments. One was, that she would wait until there was a series of public hearings on systemic racism or to hear from the community. And in those comments, she remarked that she really wanted to hear from people who are over 40. And I don't have the exact quote in front of me, but people who are over 40 who haven't been so impacted by revisionist history, essentially, is what she was saying.
Yeah. And there's actually a term for that, for the training that I do around microaggressions. That's called a micro-invalidation. And what that means is that she is dismissing the concerns, credibility, and experience of other communities and demographics by focusing specifically on an age preference that she wants to hear from in terms of perspective. And then there's also this vague assumption that she's making about what is being taught in schools around racism. And I've received a lot of feedback from teachers about that. And they're shocked that she would make that comment, because one of the problems that we have of an institutional racism within our schools is that when you look at our social studies classes, for example, we do not teach Black history. We do not teach the oppression and systemic racism that has existed in the United States since the founding of the colonies. We touch on it, we mention it, but it is a very whitewashed history that we do. So for her to be making this comment about rewriting history, I would say history has already been rewritten and has been taught in our schools, where we don't talk about race in the classroom as much as we should do, so that we understand what our history is and that we are able to improve ourselves as a community, not to repeat the same mistakes that Eileen is repeating in some of the comments that she is making that have been made for decades and centuries by white elected officials that perpetuate and protect systemic racism in their communities. And there's a whole history that anyone can look up behind that. And so it's something that should not be tolerated and needs to continually be held publicly accountable. I think Evergreen Public Schools still has a long ways to go, but I am optimistic and hopeful that we are moving forward to being an anti-racist school district. And I would point to the recent hiring of Clarissa Hightower to be the new equity coordinator or director for Evergreen Public Schools. That is a first step and an important step in order to address institutional racism in Evergreen Public Schools.
Yeah, and I just want to do a quick shout out also for the materials that are created by Rethinking Schools, which has a great anti-racist curriculum and has been doing really good work in integrating the Black Lives Matter movement into the curriculum. My guest today has been Adam Aguilera, who is a high school English teacher with the Evergreen School District and was a 2019 candidate for the Vancouver City Council. He is also a board member of the Washington Education Association. Adam, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
This has been Desiree Hilligers for the Old Mill Variety Hour.
You explained it to me, I must admit, but just for the record, you were talking. Long rap about no not being legislated for the people you've always hated in this hellhole that we call home. No knock, the man will say, to keep that man from beating his wife. No knock, the man will say, to protect people from themselves. No knocking, head rocking, enter shocking, shooting, cussing, killing, crying, lying, and being white. No knock.
That song, entitled No Knock, was written and performed by Gil Scott-Heron in 1972. No-knock warrants permit law enforcement agents to forcibly enter a property without announcement. A no-knock warrant was what resulted in the recent death of unarmed and innocent Breonna Taylor. Before that, Desiree Hellegers was speaking with teacher and activist Adam Aguilera about the insistence by County Council Chair Eileen Keering that systemic racism does not exist in Clark County. To close our show today, Norm Diamond reads from and comments on a poem by Irish poet John O'Donohue entitled For Citizenship. The poem speaks to the urgency of turning our anxiety and distraction into anger and solidarity.
The Portland neighborhood where I live is enhanced by poetry. One neighbor, herself a published poet, prints chalk poems out on the sidewalk. Those tend to be short, insightful, sentimental little clips from poets like Emily Dickinson. In one direction, well, actually in both different directions in the neighborhood, people put out poetry boxes where they periodically rotate through some of their favorite poetry. It's in one of those boxes that I found this poem. It's called For Citizenship. It's by John O'Donohue. O'Donohue is new to me. It turns out, as I research him, he is an Irish poet, died about a dozen years ago, has a theological background, which will come out a bit in this poetry, and wrote a thesis on Hegelian philosophy. This is For Citizenship. What I'm going to do is read you the poem and then look at a variant of the poem. He published different versions, and to me they're significantly different, actually, but appropriate for us. For Citizenship by John O'Donohue. In these times when anger is turned into anxiety and someone has stolen the horizons and mountains, our small emperors on parade never expect our indifference to disturb their nakedness. They keep their heads down and their eyes gleam with reflection from aluminum economic ground. The media wraps everything in a cellophane of sound, and the ghost surface of the virtual overlays the breathing earth. The industry of distraction makes us forget that we live in a universe. We have become converts to the religion of stress and its deity of progress. That we may have courage to turn aside from it all and come to kneel down before the poor to discover what we must do, how to turn anxiety back into anger, how to find our way home. That's For Citizenship, a published version that John O'Donohue put in his book, Benedictus. There's a line in there that I'm not too fond of, and that's kneeling down before the poor. It, to me, suggests a separation from the poor, but I understand its origin, and it comes out of O'Donohue's theological training, I'm sure. You may remember the preferential option for the poor, that phrase that came out of the Latin American Bishops' Conference in Medellin, Colombia, back in the late 60s. I think that's what he's talking about. In any case, I came up with another version of that same poem that is, I think, significantly different. The line breaks are different, but also, well, let me just tell you some of the differences as he wrote it. It's interesting to see the development of different versions of the same poetry. Instead of someone has stolen the horizons and mountains, he wrote in a different version, and they are replacing all the lines of horizon. Instead of aluminum economic ground, well, actually, he added the economic in the version that I read to you. And here's a significant difference. In a different version, he wrote, "And every day the media wraps the silence of our anxiousness inside a cellophane of sound, and all the while a virtual ghost surface seeps across the breathing earth and claims the allegiance of our eyes. Finally, toward the end, he wrote in a different version that we may have the courage not to stay lost in the familiar places. And he wants to turn our anxiety in this version into righteous anger. This has been John O'Donohue's poem for Citizenship. And I want to mention that next week on the Old Mole Variety Hour, we will also have poetry, a brand new poem from Desiree Heligers. This has been Norm Diamond with poetry from John O'Donohue.
We've come to the end of our show today. I want to thank Moles Bill Resnick, Tom Becker, Desiree Heligers, and Norm Diamond for their contributions this morning. A special thanks to our guests, Michael Albert and Adam Aguilera, for their insights, and profound gratitude to the hardworking staff at KBOO who have managed to keep the station alive and on the air during these challenging times. This is Patricia Kullberg, your host today for the Old Mole Variety Hour. If you can, please consider a donation to your community radio station, KBOO. Just go to kboo.org and click on Donate Today. Within the day, we will post a downloadable podcast of today's show and its individual segments to the website at kboo.org. We will also post links to additional material that might interest you. You can contact the Old Mole at oldmolevarietyhour@gmail.com with your questions and comments. Every Monday morning, the Old Mole offers commentary from the point of view of the 99% and a vision of a radically democratic world. Join us again next Monday morning at 9 a.m. for more interviews and reviews from a socialist, feminist perspective. As always, thanks for listening. Today we're going to go out with the gorgeous and inspirational song by Andra Day from 2015, entitled Rise Up. It was nominated for a Grammy Award in 2016 and has since become an anthem of protest and empowerment.
You're broken down and tired of living life on the merry-go-round, and you can't find a fighter, but I see it in you, so we gon' walk it out. Move mountains. We gon' walk it out and move mountains.